Well, greetings to everybody. Nice to see you all again, as usual. Some people get stronger when they endure trials of life. Others go to pieces when they endure trials of life. The ones that get stronger seem to be the ones that make room for God in their lives. Others who do not do that oftentimes are more emotional, sometimes can get bitter, sometimes can, in fact, start criticizing God. One of our youngest ministers years ago got a call late one night. The information was sketchy. There had been a terrible three-car accident. One church member was killed. Another young adult of the church was in critical condition. And this man was called to go to the hospital. And he was brand new. This goes back a long time ago. He was brand new. He had, in fact, only been ordained for a few months in the field ministry at the tender age of 22, and he had never been to a hospital. Hard to imagine. Now, let alone an ICU room. There's nothing wrong with being young, by the way. It certainly says in Ecclesiastes, rejoice in your youth. It's fantastic. I'd like to be that age again. But when this man arrived at the ICU, his stomach was understandably queasy. He was mortified at the sight of the surviving girl. Her chest had been crushed in. So many broken bones, wires running everywhere, tubes everywhere. He was going to anoint her, but he wondered, well, where do I place my hands? Not on her head. There's bandages and everything. Well, maybe the shoulder? No. And so that was just a quandary all by itself. She was hooked up to a room full of machines and heart monitors and oxygen, and seemingly the wires were endless. And she was awake. He felt gravely inadequate. She was totally conscious. She couldn't talk, but her longing puppy dog eyes followed him around the room and looking for answers. And it was time for him to do something. It was time for him to say the appropriate statements. And yet, he felt quite inadequate. The answers that he gave were the answers that he learned just a few months prior at Ambassador College. And they were good answers. But as he said later, it felt a little bit empty. The empathy may not have been there because I hadn't been through something like that myself. I'd never seen something like this. And so he gulped and started talking, and he gave the pat answers, and as he said later, they weren't the shallow answers that they seemed to be then. It was what needed to be said for the occasion. But it pointed out a question, and it's one that recurs through our time, and that is, do you panic when it becomes a little tough serving God? Or when a trial of your faith occurs in the form of a great trial, or maybe a seemingly endless stream of little trials that never quit? By trials, I mean adversity, misfortune, distress, hardships, maybe a grievous wound, trials of health, or other trials. God does not intend, of course, for trials to be endless and all-consuming. In Psalm 23, for example, it doesn't say, He makes me lie down in Death Valley and allow me to spend all my days there. Instead, Psalm 23 indicates, the Lord's Prayer, will indicate, He, quote, leads me into green pastures by the still waters. He restoreth my soul. In a Christian's life, there will be various trials and challenges, and then there will be times where there may not be so many. And where there might be, as David said, a wide place. Maybe a time of respite, a time of restoration or rejuvenation in a different way. But trials are certainly a part of life. And what I'd like to do this afternoon is to address why they are a part of a Christian's life. How can trials enhance the life of all of us? You know, this is what Job wanted to know. We've covered some of Job in recent Bible studies here in Tampa. But Job was a person who was a statesman. He was well known and highly respected in his community. He writes in several different chapters that people would give great veneration and honor to him. Even the elderly that were much older than him would rise in his presence because he was considered a great man. And in fact, he was a righteous person. Self-righteous. There were some chinks in the armor, but certainly by comparison to the people around him, he was a phenomenal person. He was a man of integrity. He would say things like, if I've hurt anybody, I'll make it up. If my sons or whatever have sinned, I will have an offering for them, anticipating. And if I consider that the people that I employed, I took good care of. They wouldn't need workman's comp under me because I would go over and above. And he was an extraordinarily individual, and he was incredibly wealthy, but he lost everything. Very few of us have ever lost everything. All of his vast wealth was suddenly ripped away from him. He lost all of his sons and all of his daughters. He agonized with horrible boils, and he felt that he needed to banish himself from society. And he sat in ashes, which provided some marginal relief for the open sores and the wounds that he had. And adding insult to injury, three acquaintances came to persistently needle him and accuse him of sinning. Even his wife counseled him to curse God and die. And so, with all the pressure and weight of all these trials, so many of them induced by Satan, at God's permission, he went through all of this. He didn't understand why, and he was going through a great deal of suffering. And he did the thing that so many people do. The tendency when people do is to say, why? Why this? Why did this happen to me? How come? It's not fair. I know other people that have done this and that, but why am I singled out? How come? God must have known. And the questions of why are not so unusual. I'd like for us to go over to Job and see how he naturally asked this. But because he was a righteous man, and he had seen God intervene and bless him for his diligence, but it didn't compute, or it didn't seem possible that he would go through something like this. In verse 11, after calculating all that he had lost, he said in verse 11, why wasn't I born dead? Why didn't I die as I came from the womb? Reading from a New Living Translation here. Verse 12, why was I laid on my mother's lap? Why did she nurse me at her breast? And then additional verses. Verse 20, oh, why give light to those in misery? Verse 23, why is life given to those with no future? That's typical. I can remember one person, he was manic depressive, and he visited here one time, and well, for several weeks, and he would corner me after the parking lot had emptied out and people were gone, and he'd say, I'm just angry, and he certainly was. And he had all these different issues. It went back to childhood, back to the union, back to other jobs that he had, and he wasn't making a go of it here, and he was upset, and he was in... I don't think it was a midlife crisis, but it was a crisis, and he was asking, why this? Why? Why? Can somebody explain it? Make sense out of it all? Resolve it? That is so common, but there's a better question to ask, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. A far more mature question that reflects a deeper level of conversion. But Job had everything taken away from him, and I hardly fault him at all for asking these questions, because I think any of us would do the same thing. This was a huge, major trial, and it was one that was overwhelming, or so it seemed. There is a promise, 1 Corinthians 10:13, that God will not allow anybody to face something that that person cannot handle. And it's important that we remember that. Sometimes we might think, and I've heard it from others, I can't take it anymore. And God is still there to monitor what happens. He doesn't allow anything to happen that is overwhelming. But this huge trial of his, of Job's, was one of the greatest, most severe trials that have ever been recorded or ever been experienced. Not all trials are of this scope and magnitude. They come in all shapes and sizes. Trials, in a sense, are like going through high school and college. You can take Algebra 1, for example, and after you complete that, you move into maybe Geometry and then Algebra 2. Now, what would you think is better, getting an A in Algebra 1 or a B minus in Algebra 2? Maybe you get an ace to test in Algebra 1, and the questions were things like X plus 3 equals 5. Well, X then would be 2. But in Algebra 2, you might get a question, the square root of 132 times 14 over 9 to the third power is equal to 2 plus 27 squared over 32 to the square root of 32 minus 4. And you've got to work that problem out. So those that harass my math are going to get all over me for that. I know that. Regardless, I would rather get the B minus in Algebra 2 that would indicate that I knew at least some of what I just said, and I would know that if I could at least do that well in Algebra 2, Algebra 1 would be a breeze. What about first year Spanish? Would it be better to get an A minus in first year Spanish, or say a B in fourth year Spanish? Now, in first year, you might learn the phrase "Cómo está usted," which means "How are you?" So maybe you get an A minus because you know those words, and as it comes on a test. But in fourth year Spanish, it might be con toda la franqueza, yo no necesito esas cosas, and just rattle it on. Well, that would be a little more challenging. If I could get a B doing a fourth year, that would mean a lot more than getting an A in first year Spanish. Now, there is no such a thing as first year trials. In Ambassador College, they would have first year Bible and second year Bible, and you'd work your way up to the apostles' writings in the New Testament. But in a sense, you could say that as we graduate through Christianity, we could start out with first-year trials and advance to second and third year, and you hope that you're able to master 10th or 20th year trials by the time the great tribulation, the day of the Lord, comes. Because no matter what we experience now compared to what's going to happen later, well, that's a quantum leap. And do we have the faith, the confidence that God can work us and shape us and mold us as a master potter to go from where we are to where He wants us to be? And one of the reasons He does say that, He says, I love these people. I want them to be around for eternity. I don't want them to go through, to flunk out of fifth-year trials, like maybe a third of the angels did following Lucifer, because they lacked the character and the vision, and they weren't convicted that Christ or God was correct. He has to know that He knows about us. We have to have character. We can't earn our salvation, but our efforts matter, and we are rewarded according to our works. And He doesn't want us to just stay in a happy comfort zone. He's great, glad when we're happy, but if we are not making any progress, if we're not developing any spiritual muscle, then you think of what it says in Proverbs 10:24. He that faints in the day of adversity, his strength is small. We don't want that to happen to us. I don't think we do. So what would be better, getting an A in first-year trials or a B in fourth-year trial or a D in 20th-year trials? I would rather be able to be at least on the map in some of those higher categories, even if I kept stumbling along. I'll never forget when I went to my wife's dad's funeral. It was at a different denomination. And just before it started, I was talking to a woman who had been attending there for 45 years. And she was quite upset. She wasn't sure she'd be coming back. I said, how come you say that? She says, well, you see this marquee plaque on the wall up there that's got the numbers of the hymns? I put those numbers there week after week, Sunday after Sunday. Not only that, you see that altar? Yeah, there was this altar in front. I was the one that put the green the pine branches, the green pine branches on there every week and decorated it. So what's the problem? Well, say, got some kid doing it now. To her, everybody under the age of 60 was a kid. So somebody age 60 apparently horned in on her territory and took away her identity. And to me, this was not even a trial. I think it would be pabulum for any of us. If it happened to me, I'd say, great, I'll vacuum the floor, I'll move a chair, I'll do something else. But she just didn't know if she could go that far. She was getting a D- in first-year trials. If you faint in the day of adversity, and this was a small adversity, you know, when strength, spiritual strength is indeed small. Now, God would love somebody like that and say, I'll give that person a chance. I want to see that person in the God family. Now, I don't know what her timetable is. I never saw her before or since. She might have a difficult time just following everything that I've told you. And you don't know sometimes what it's like for somebody, unless you've been in their moccasins. You don't know sometimes what it's like for somebody that might be struggling with a problem, but maybe they're in a higher level than you are. Only God knows. Just one more reason why we need not be evaluating and judging each other in this particular sense. It was a case of one man, veteran minister, Bill McDowell, years ago. He took a 25-year-old ministerial trainee with him, and they visited this elderly man. He was 90 years old. He was in traction. His leg was hoisted up in the air. He had broken a hip. He had arthritis. He had gout. He had all kinds of problems. He couldn't move around. He was aching, and it was just a hassle, just a chore. And he was upset and just hated missing the chance to be outside. And so the two of them visited him. And he went on, and he cursed, and he swore, and he was screaming, and he was griping about all kinds of things. Mr. McDowell says, uh-huh, uh-huh. And then what happened? And then, well, how do you feel about that? And how do you feel about that? Uh-huh, okay. After an hour, he said, well, I want to come back, but we have to keep going because we have to do these other visits or whatever it was. And so they left, and the assistant said when they got in the car, boss, man, you should have jumped all over him. I can't believe that you just let him do that, you know. And he ranted and raved and so forth. He says, have you ever been 90 years old? Well, no, I'm 25. He says, neither have I. Let me ask you another question. Have you ever been to traction, had a hip broken, and been in agony and pain that's excruciating? There's not enough morphine or drugs or anything else to get you out of it, and it goes on and on and on. You can't leave. You can't do anything. You're stuck there, and you got your leg hoisted in the air, and it's extremely uncomfortable, and your back is sore. He says, no, never been there. And now let me ask you one more thing. Have you ever been in traction and had a broken hip and all these other things and this wrong and that wrong and everything wrong and you're aching, you're hurting and hurting and you're 90 years old? No, neither have I. So I'll cut him some slack. I don't know what level he's on. Maybe he's flunking out of first-year trials, but it sure doesn't look like first-year trial to me. It looks like a major challenge. I'll go back. I'll work with him. No, you're not allowed. You're not supposed to take God's name in vain. No, you're not supposed to, you know, curse and get upset over every person. There's got to be a better way. But, you know, people take understanding. They take time. You just can't blow people out of the water. You just have to, you want to redeem people. It's an unfinished business. But, you know, we have to understand that some trials are not easy. And not always do we go through trials with flying colors. Consider the life of Joseph, who was sold into slavery by his brothers. Now, maybe you could argue that he was in an eighth-year level. There is no such thing as levels identified in the Bible, but I think that you understand that there's a graduation of ability to handle different challenges that the Bible certainly illustrates. And Joseph's life, I'll just summarize, he was sold to the Midianites. Unfair? You bet it was. God understood he could have stopped it, but he was sold to the Midianites. Then he ended up with Potiphar. That seemed to be working out because he seemed to be a good employer, but then Potiphar's wife framed him, lied about him. He ended up in jail. Most of us would probably go ballistic if that happened. They can't do that to me. That's not fair. God could say, that's not fair. Get used to it. Then the butler listened, and Joseph said, look, you're going to get out of this prison, and you're going to be restored to your original responsibilities. And when you go, you've got to promise me, because I have helped you and I've interpreted your dream, that when you get back there, you let them know that I am here unjustly and get me out of this place. I certainly will. He got out, and he certainly forgot. And a couple of years went by. It was only when Pharaoh had his dream that, oh, I remember my faults this day. There's a man in this prison that interprets dreams. And that's when Joseph was able to turn things around. So many other people would have cracked under the pressure. And they would have asked, why? Why was this unfair? And on top of that, you know, I was sold, thrown into a pit, then sold by my brothers. That should be enough for anybody. Instead, I go down to Egypt, and I face prison time, and everything seems to go wrong. Some people would have cracked. And even Job was under strain. We saw that in chapter 3. Why this? Why that? The more mature question to ask, easy to say, hard to do, is how? How can I deal with this? What do I do? Where I am right now, as I am, what can I do? Joseph had to ask that. Here I am, I'm sold down the river, and I'm helpless in Egypt. Well, I can learn the language. I can communicate. I can pick up skills. I can develop my inclination to manage money, which he was extremely good at, and organization. He was thrown into the prison of the king or the pharaoh, and he started learning about the court and about how the situations operated in Egypt. He talked to different people that knew, people that were not trying to hide anything or play politics. They'd been around Pharaoh, but it was like, hey, I don't care. If this guy wants to ask me questions, I'll let it all hang out. So he got and he ingratiated himself with the butler and the baker. So he was able to learn and develop skills. How? How do I deal with my trial? How do I get through it? How do I increase my value to God? What can I do instead of what can't I do? Where do I go from here? And if I can't seem to do much, God will reward according to me doing everything I can with what little I have. Health trials. Common as the day is long. To so many in the church. And if we all live long enough, we all get there, sooner or later. And probably some that have them say, you know, I remember 5 or 6 decades ago, I never dreamed that day would come. But we ask the same questions. How do I land on my feet? How do I cope? How can I rightly set a good example? How do I increase my skill? How can I make a difference for other people, maybe in different ways, whatever it is? The questions remain the same. It's how. That's maturity. Why means I haven't gotten off a dead center. I just can't understand why I'm here. And it ain't fair, and there I am. God expects more than that. Joseph waited on God. Joseph walked with God. He worked for God. He witnessed for God. He worshiped God. There's an old adage that states, and it applies sometimes to people that seem like they have had life just close in on them. When you're down to nothing, God is up to something. Sometimes if we are at the end of our rope, we have to remember, God is not that far away from us. Mr. McQuinn already quoted Hebrews 13:5, so I won't turn there. Where it says at the end, I will never leave you nor forsake you. There are other promises in the Bible, and I've quoted 1 Corinthians 10:13. I will never, God says, allow a trial to occur that you would be overwhelmed by. You'll be able to handle anything that comes your way. For him to be able to do that, he has to monitor us all the time. He has to be aware of our circumstances more intimately than we probably realize because, well, I can't see God, so therefore he perhaps forgets I exist. No, he's very, very interested in the first fruits. He wants the brethren of God because he wants them in his kingdom, and they are the ones that he's working with directly at this point in time. And so he's extremely interested in our decision making. So he wants to help us. He wants to steer us. And trials can mold and help our endurance. Certainly can. That can even be illustrated, of all things, by golf balls. Do you know that years ago, the manufacturers of golf balls made balls that were round, smooth, like billiards, table, pool balls? And then somebody realized, you know what? When I hack at this ball and I put little gouges on it and it gets roughed up, it goes further. And from that, other people decided, you know what? If we take a cover full of dimples and put it over this round ball, it'll even go further still. That's why they have that. As I explained to St. Pete this morning, remember you heard it here first about those dimples. Just kidding. But for better or for worse, like it or not like it, we seem to grow more, we seem to accomplish more when we go through bits of adversity. And that seems to be part of the Christian calling. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, Psalm 34:19. But the Lord delivers them out of all. Let me move now to a very unusual story, circumstance. It took place just a few years ago in the nation of Chile, South America, at the San Jose mine that was just off the water up in the mountains of northern Chile. And in this particular mine, it was 121 years of age. It was over a half a mile deep, 2,300 feet, down, straight down. That's an old mine, and one that probably should have been condemned. There was a lot of loose, massive debris in that region. It was unstable, and the miners didn't understand that. The management didn't. The 33 were dropped down to the bottom, and they were working, and suddenly there was this gigantic, enormous explosion, or so it sounded like, and enormous amounts of earth dropped down and sealed off the shaft. The amount of dirt that moved, or just dirt, rock, boulders, everything, ledge, was enough to build a 45-story building. And the amount of weight of all of that was double the weight of the Empire State Building. And it just dropped down, sealed off the shaft, and 33 miners were trapped on the bottom. That was an awful sound. And when you're down there, you start to wonder right away, will there be a way out of here? And if I didn't ever have a relationship with God, I think maybe I better get one now. And is God even able to provide a way of escape? So here they were in this very dimly lit cave, and no communication with the people up top. They took inventory of the food that they had, which involved a couple boxes of cookies, a few cans of tuna, and 10 bottles of water. That would be enough to take care of that group for about 2 days. So the deal was every man would eat two cookies and one spoonful of tuna fish every day. Otherwise, they preoccupied themselves with the games of checkers. They were able to take cardboard and cut out squares, play games, and one man ingeniously took some scrap plastic and then made some dominoes. And so some people played that. That went on for 2 weeks. Then they took inventory again and decided that each man would eat one cookie every 2 days. That's all they had. And occasionally they'd be rattled because they'd hear falling debris somewhere. And they'd think, oh no, is this the end? Well, no, not now. Maybe tomorrow, maybe tonight. And they live with this uncertainty. Up top now, 2,000 family members and workers gathered. And there was a huge appeal to other countries, other people, help from whatever. An American engineer was brought in to head the rescue effort. Three drills were brought in from other countries. The camp at the top was called Camp Esperanza, which means Camp of Hope. But any drilling that would happen could create even more instability and seal the doom of those 33 down below for eternity, so it seemed. After all of this time, now you could have this, not you could have, there was the scent of death, the smell of death in the air, and just fetid air. And the only water left was water of the troughs that were conduits to the machinery to keep them cool, in the same similar way that a radiator of a car will keep the engine cool. And people could drink water, dirty water, from that. But now there were grim jokes of cannibalism. All of the 33 agreed on one thing, that if anybody ever survived, that if somebody wrote an article or made a book and it earned some money, that the proceeds would be evenly divided, 33 portions. They could agree on that, but nothing else. They were getting on each other's nerves. Some were emotionally at their breaking point. One person said, that, I think, is where Satan would want to get somebody, at the depth of their breaking point. And a couple people that decided later to dedicate their lives to God as best as they knew how, talked about the fact that they were very vulnerable to negative thinking because it all looked so hopeless, looked so helpless and dim. And that's where at least a few of them came across a scripture in Isaiah 55 and verse 6, and I'll read that here. And what we ought to do, whether we're having a trial or not, but it helps whether we're having a trial or not. Isaiah 55, verse 6. Seek the Lord while you can find Him. Call on Him while He is near. And God is close. In Hebrews 13, verse 5, again back to the scripture that we heard the sermon at, it is emphatically stated in the Greek language, I will not forsake you, no, nor ever forsake you. And it's expressed in triple negative language. In other words, it's a style in the Greek, and it's true in Spanish and other languages. It is as emphatic as God can make it, that He's not going to leave us. And we never should be a time when we feel alone. So at this point, the three engineers that were in charge of their three drills decided to drill side by side. I'm skipping ahead too fast. They did drill one drill and come to the corner of the cave, and the men were ecstatic. And they sent a message up saying, hey, we are all alive. And from then on, they were able to receive some water. But food was still a serious issue. It was hard to send things down a hole that runs for a half of a mile. And so then the three drills were put together side by side. And thinking, well, we're risking a lot. We're going to destabilize the landmass right below them. And we're hoping that if we drill, that it's not going to trigger another avalanche. And so they cautiously drilled. And the men at the bottom would hear the humming a little bit. And they would get excited, then they wouldn't hear it. And they realized the noises they heard, even as they got louder and louder, was nothing more than the grumbling of their stomachs. They looked like people out of Auschwitz or Dachau. They were becoming emaciated. You could see the ribs on because there was no flesh left. And it did look grim. And the people at the top did level with them and say, if we can pull this off, and this started in August, You'll be lucky to be out of here in 4 months. Could they live that longer? Much longer. They didn't have any more cookies to feast on. They were in trouble. But amazingly, the drilling was efficient. And on October the 12th, they broke through. The first man to be hoisted up was Florencio Avalos. It took 30 minutes to bring him up, and he had to be in a little capsule, 28 inches wide. And so he was in there, and he made it to the top. Then he couldn't believe it. When he got out of the capsule, there was a sea of humanity there. The president of Chile and his wife and others shaking his hands. One of the first things they had to do was to slap a pair of heavy, thick sunglasses on him because he couldn't see, really. At that depth, for that long of a time, under malnutrition, there was temporary blindness for some of the miners. For others, they could see, but the rods and the cones changed the properties in the eye, and you become very sensitive to light. One or two of the people made the observation that if you're looking for the good in life, even a faint bit of light you pick up, and it becomes very, very prominent. And then, of course, the light of God, if we were to be at God's throne, we'd all have to shield our eyes. We couldn't see because it is so bright. And so this first man came. Let me apologize in the sense that those after him needed the sunglasses. He actually came up, I believe, at midnight. But it took 24 hours to get all 33 out of there. The thing that is amazing is the timing has to be perfect. You could have said, it was not fair. I don't like the way God allowed this to happen. He should have enabled those people to drill within a couple of days of the time that this catastrophe happened and bring them out. But could he have? Remember, they had to get in these capsules. They were in less than 28 inches of clearance. So they'd have to get in like this and hold their position for the next 30 minutes as they were being pulled out. And when you're like this, you have to scrunch in order to make sure you fit in that capsule. They were emaciated enough that they could fit. If a rescue operation had been attempted months prior, wouldn't have happened. They would have been too big to make it into there. So, to me, there's an interesting spiritual analogy. Sometimes God has to let sufficient time go by in our trials until we shed certain character flaws that we have. For him to intervene prematurely means that he'll shortchange us. We won't have that development, and that's the goal of this. It's the goal of trials. It's a tool that God uses. And sometimes we will inflict a trial on ourselves. It might be a trial that should have never happened. Let's say the guy that's got 12 credit cards, he decides to max them out. Not a good idea. Getting mixed up with the wrong crowd or the wrong person. Never a good idea. That creates trials. But even those kind of trials can be utilized by the individual with God's help to shape and mold them, because God is the master potter, to shed certain character flaws, to turn things around, to make things work. Those 33 miners were trapped in this particular trial for 69 days. That was over twice as long as any other miners that were ever rescued. I think that we could conclude that these were not first-year trials for those 33. But to reinforce that statement, the men came very, very close to having strife and anarchy and cannibalism. But rescue came in time, and they did not lose hope. God is a master potter, and we cannot forget that. He wants more than a hunky-dory existence for us on this earth. He wants a wonderful eternal life in his family. He can't make that happen unless he provides us with growth opportunities. We can protest. In Isaiah 45, verse 9, there's a warning to those that do. Isaiah 45 and verse 9. I'll read this from the King James. Woe to him that strives with his maker. Let the potsherd strive with the potsherds of the earth. Shall the clay say to him that fashioned it, what makes you? Or your work, has he no hands? In this translation, it says, what sorrow awaits those who argue with their creator? Does a clay pot argue with its maker? Does a clay dispute with the one that's shaping it, saying, stop, you're doing it all wrong? Does the pot exclaim, how clumsy are you? Now that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. We have a kiln, a pottery kiln at our house, and we have to use extreme heat to make the clay turn into something that's ceramic. It takes about 3 firings to make that happen, and each one is at 2,000 or more degrees. Typically, people, human nature being what it is, people will tend to want to say, don't expose me to heat. I want to return to the class that I'm more comfortable in. First year trials. I think I can handle that trial about the greenery on this altar. Well, I'll just go vacuum a rug instead of doing that. I can get an A in first year trial, but don't talk to me about all this heat. That people can say to God, if they're cracking, if they're upset, if they forget that there's rhyme and reason to what they're going through, how dare you allow me to walk through the valley of death? How dare you not take away my health trial right now? How can you just allow me to be slandered? How can you not rain down upon me my, not daily bread, but monthly or yearly bread? Why must I have enemies for righteous' sake? Why do the godly experience persecution? 2 Timothy 3:1, 3:12. So, we're not to argue with God. We do what we can, try to enhance their circumstances, of course. But when we get to a roadblock and there are things there that are beyond our control, and we just have to stand at the Red Sea and ask God to part it. And if he doesn't depart it immediately, it doesn't mean that all is lost. It means that he's making us stronger. He doesn't tempt us above that which we're able to handle. And whether it's a master potter or maybe a silversmith, there is the desire to burn away or get rid of what is not ideal, not the part of the piece of art, the bowl or the statue or whatever that's being fashioned. The silversmith has to use even more intense heat to get rid of the dross that comes with the gold or the silver. And I'll just refer to Malachi 3, verses 2 through 3, where it talks in terms of God works with a people and melts the dross away, even purifies the sons of Levi, is able to transform people with character flaws into a greater, more godly unit or nation or people. And he's had to do that time and time again with ancient Israel. By all indication, we'll need to do that again in the near future with this world. One of the things the silversmith has to realize is that if he takes a piece of silver, maybe it's a statue, something, and he's trying to work with it and purify and get rid of the slag, get rid of the impurities, that he needs to expose the flaws to heat. But he has to be careful that he doesn't hold exposure for too long, or it will destroy the metal. Just like God, as the silversmith or the master potter, he may hold us close to a flame, and he says, I know this is uncomfortable. I'm not going to do it too much, but I'm going to do it enough just to get the right result. He has to know about us all the time, in intimate detail. Now, how does God know when to end a trial? How does a silversmith know when, okay, I've exposed enough heat to this art object, it's okay. It looks pretty good, but I really know it's okay. When does a silversmith know? I can remember a sermon that Bill Bradford gave some time ago at the General Conference in Cincinnati. He knows, the silversmith knows, when he looks into the silver and sees his own reflection. When is God going to end your trial or mine? When he looks at us and he can see his own face reflected in us. If he doesn't see it, probably the trial's not over. Or maybe the trial is over. He says, well, I'll extend it a little longer just to stretch the patience of that person, to enable that person to even be stronger. Heat is not, sometimes can be a real ally. I was surprised once we went to the Sequoia National Park, saw these gorgeous sequoia trees plus redwood trees up at 6,000-7,000 feet in elevation. They're huge things. And I just felt terrible to see the aftermath of certain forest fires that had raged through. Sometimes they'll have terrible fires, you know, in drought conditions in California in the summertime, of course. But the forest ranger that took us on a tour said, you know, sometimes it's a good thing. He says, not only is it a good thing, we deliberately set forest fires around here, but they're contained. When the wind's not blowing and we have it all rearranged, and we have staff, sufficient staff to monitor it, because the heat from the fires will kill viruses that kill trees. Not only that, the only way the forest can proliferate, the way it can, you can have saplings to grow into future trees, is for the seeds to come out of the pine cones. And they don't come out of the pine cones unless there's intense heat to crack them open. Sometimes they may seed every 20 years. But in the course of nature, there will be lightning strikes in places, and that creates fires. And maybe seeds finally come out of cracked pine cones. Some of these are so big and so hard, you can't yank them off of a branch. I've tried. But then if the seeds are loose, maybe the wind will carry them to other places miles away where there was no fire. And so the forest has a chance to rejuvenate in those ways. So even trials on the forest can be of great help, of great value. In 1 Peter 4 and verse 12, familiar scripture, 1 Peter 4 and verse 12. Says, dear brethren or friends, do not be surprised at the fiery trials that you are going through. In the King James, it says it well, think it not strange. Why? Because most people will think it strange. Wow, this came out of the blue. I can't reconcile this one. This is crazy. God knows. He's monitoring it. Maybe he doesn't like what's happening either. But he thinks there's something more important than the personal comfort of this individual right now, so I will allow it. Fiery trials. Peter lived during the time, we think, of Nero, terrible emperor in Rome. He had his other trials in the church, in prison, his life threatened. You read about that in the book of Acts. He had to go into hiding. Don't be surprised at the fiery trials that you are going through, as if some strange thing were happening to you. Instead, be very glad, for these trials make you partners with Christ in his suffering, so that you will have wonderful joy of seeing his glory when it is revealed to all the world, and we ourselves will be able to share in that glory. We'll be spirit being. We won't get tired. We'll have eternal responsibilities that ever expand. Wonderful responsibilities. And have real life, in a sense. But these are the stepping stones that are all important now. These are the formative years that lead us to the time of final exam, spiritually speaking. So the Master Potter that loves us is monitoring the things that happen. God pays strict attention, and nothing happens without his consent. He may not approve all the time of what other people do. In fact, I'm convinced that he doesn't. But he will take lemons and make lemonade out of them in that sense. Let me give you a couple other quotes. Psalm 66, verse 10. For God, you have tested us, says David. You have refined us as silver is refined. Isaiah 48, verse 10. I have tested you in the furnace of affliction. This leads me to discussing the sheep with the broken leg, something that happened in Switzerland. A woman was walking by and hiking in the mountains and saw the shepherd, and she was impressed. All these darling sheep were surrounding the shepherd, and he was feeding them and talking to them, petting them. And then she saw over on the side, on this bale of pile of hay, was another sheep who was on its side. It seemed to still be in discomfort. And so she said, "Well, what's wrong with that sheep over there?" And he nonchalantly said, "Well, I broke its leg." "You broke its leg?" And he said, "Yes, you see, of all of my sheep, this one was the most wayward. It would not obey my voice and would not follow where I was leading the flock. And on more than one occasion, it wandered too close to the cliff, and it was steering and getting other sheep to follow it right over to the cliff. So I broke its leg. I knew I had no choice." Sometimes God may not have a choice with us. The shepherd went on to say, "The next day when I tried to feed it, it tried to bite my hand. So I left it alone for several days. Then I went back to feed it, and it licked my hand, and it showed every sign of submission and affection. From experience, I know that when it walks again, it will be a model sheep, and it will help me by keeping the others in close proximity." Now, sometimes in trials, God will have to spank occasionally to redirect us. But he only does that with those whom he loves, Hebrews 12, verse 6. The outcome, of course, is up to you or me. Now, everybody's on a different timetable. But I think God was ready to break my leg at age 18 when he was leading me to understand the truth about the Sabbath. Everybody's on a different timetable. But I'll just tell you what happened to me, if I haven't already one. I decided, okay, I'm going to keep the Sabbath. I got a phone call at my place of work up on the hill. "Hey, we need you. Emergency thing. We got to get this project done." "Oh, okay." I went up there. We're going to move all these logs. It was a total waste of time because everything we did was like turned into disaster. We finally took hours to get these logs into this bucket on this big tractor, and the bolt broke, and all the logs fell and rolled off the road and down the hill. And then it took us 4 more hours to get them all back up. At the end of the day, I thought, we haven't accomplished anything. Next Sabbath, I'm reading some literature. Phone rings. "Hey, good thing you're home. We need you to come up here. We got to get something done." "Oh, okay." I go up. Very inefficient. I felt empty about it. Third time. "Hey," they call me up. "We're lifting up this I-beam. We got 5 people. We need 6, and you're the guy. And so you got to help us." So I go up. Okay, I'm thinking, well, I'll just get this out of the way. Hoist this thing up high, and we got it in place. It was great. But my back hurt, and I limped home. Next week, phone rings. Gotta go do something. So I go back up there. We're going to move rock and sod and everything, and there's this flatbed that's hitched on a tractor. And this guy was a bit dense. He didn't remember that I was on the flatbed. And he jerks this thing into gear, and I step back, and my foot goes into the well of the tire well, right there where it could get caught between the tire and the rest of the flatbed. In other words, if I screamed and he stopped it. If he didn't stop it, it would have chewed my leg all up, ground it like a meat grinder. And I got out of that, and I limped home, and I thought, next week I'll be dead. It's not going to happen. So next week the master shepherd is going to have to break my leg. Everybody's different. But in James chapter 1 and verse 2, says, "Dear brothers and sisters, when troubles come your way, consider it an opportunity for great joy." You've got to be kidding. I've never really been joyful over any adversity that I've ever faced. I've been quite the opposite at times. But then the person writing this was getting an A in 20th year trials. And I'm wondering why I can't just turn back the page. One life was more innocent, and I wasn't challenged with much. No, we have to consider where we are and make the most out of it and ask for God to help us and to see that the joy comes from the end result. A weightlifter may not be thinking when he's hoisting 400 pounds, saying, "This is making me so happy." But then when later on, if he wins the Charles Atlas Award, if they have such a thing, he says, "Yeah, it was worth it, all the hard work," or all the work that goes into winning a Super Bowl, or whatever it is. Adversity seems to need to be part of life. And just because we're maybe unable to do what we could do before, or 50 years ago, doesn't mean that life is less important, maybe more significant now. How we finish the race, how we do in these upper-level trials is very, very significant. There's no easier way. If there was, God would have invented it by now. There's one example or illustration that's brought out to support that concept, and that would be the development of the butterfly that comes out of its cocoon. And many a person has looked, children, even adults, and seen a butterfly just standing there with its wings, unable to open them, and is struggling to move them. And God has designed it that way, because with there's fluid in the lungs and in the rest of the body of that butterfly that needs to be flushed out into the wings that gives them lubrication and helps the wings to fly. But liquid has to come out of the butterfly itself. And so the only way it does it, it looks like it's struggling, and it is, to open its wings and continue to do that until it can fly. And people have come along and said, "Oh, I feel so sorry for that butterfly. Let's make it easy. We'll just open those wings up there. Now he's ready to do it." They don't realize he can't fly at all. And he's still got this congestion. He's probably going to die. He won't survive. Can't. It's not designed to. Has to go through this pumping exercise that seems to be so arduous. It happens. It definitely happens. I don't know what the future holds specifically, but when we read the book of Revelation, when we read the history of the church in the last 2,000 years and the certain patterns and what the apostles went through, it seems to me that we have greater challenges in the future than we've ever experienced in the past. Had we not had some of the trials that we've had, your health trials maybe trials with other people, or trials at work, or in school, or whatever, you and I might not be considered candidates at this point to be ready for the next phase of God's work and His activity and our development in it. You know, it is a stepping stone. Any trial that you and I experienced has the potential to bring us either closer to God or drive us further away, depending on the relationship that we have with our Creator. So where do we go from here specifically? We need to learn what we can about trusting God. He's got to be part of our life. We still are challenged to do an end-time work in this post-Christian era, with toleration for religion perhaps being severely on the wane. Caring about the different developments in it, whether it's praying for eye and television, the impact of that, or local activities, or anything in between. We need to be convicted to shed our character flaws, and perhaps only we know what they are. We're suggested that we take inventory of ourselves at Passover and at other times. Let a man examine himself, 2 Corinthians 13:5. Why not? Why wait till Passover? Praying for more faith and confidence in God, knowing that if God started a work in me or you, that He will complete it. We have to have an abiding and confident faith in that our life matters, our trials matter, our outcomes matter, what God wants to do with us matters. That He can take any situation that we have and develop us to be have a more significant character and to be more valuable. So for that, we can count it joy. But it takes faith, it takes confidence, and it takes a review of the other men and women of the Bible that have gone through these challenging trials in their time. And there have been many. And they're all noteworthy, and many are recorded for our admonition, for our examples, and for our development. So let us be glad that there is rhyme and reason to what we experience, that is leading to something valuable, character, and eternal life, and that God is behind us, and the trials are part of our human development and our spiritual development.